Amy Goodman is the most famous alternative newswoman on the planet. She hosts Democracy Now!, played on 500 radio stations, including this one, CFRO 102.7 FM. On a Wednesday night, in the largest auditorium of Vancouver's public library, hundreds of people waited to hear Amy Goodman on her new book, Breaking the Sound Barrier. Amy herself was being held at the border by Canadian customs officers. Border guards rummaged through the contents of the laptops and cell phones of Amy and her editor, Dennis Moynihan. She was grilled about the contents of her upcoming speech. Finally, Goodman realized they wanted to know what she would say about the 2010 Olympics, which wasn't even on her radar. That's how far it's gone. That's how little free speech we actually have left. An hour later, Amy and Dennis were released. They arrived to a cheering crowd, patiently waiting to hear one of the most important voices of our times. Now you get to hear 1 hour of the 80-minute speech on a Tuesday Brown Bagger program, ripped from the news. Here is Amy Goodman.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Dennis. Without Dennis, this latest book would never have been possible, who every week works with me, edits these columns, and convinced me to put it together as a book. I don't know if the book hurt or helped tonight as we were at the border. If they were more interested in the book, though the border guards were, one of them was busily reading. I was trying to see which columns he was most interested in. Another was reading Dennis's computer, also my colleague Chuck's computer, in our car, seriously concerned about what I would be saying tonight. And, you know, I'm not I generally talk quite extemporaneously. And when they said they needed to see my notes now, I had to figure out exactly what to do. So I brought out the book, and I did say I would be, you know, reading some columns. They said, we want your speech. You don't just go to a speech if, in fact, you're giving a speech without notes. So I said, well, I'm going to start, which I was going to start, with the last column, which is about Tommy Douglas. Canadian Broadcasting Corporation did a poll in 2004, said he was the greatest Canadian, and they were looking at me. I said, so I was going to talk about Tommy Douglas because of health care. It's a very important issue in the United States, and we can look north to see what's happening in the person who really pioneered this. And they were looking at me like a little like you're looking at me now, like, yeah? No, what are you really going to talk about? I said, well, Tommy Douglas was one of because in our country, we know nothing about the Canadian system, except any system that's raised outside of private health care is just called socialist. We live in a globalized world, but we are so insulated in the United States when it comes to getting information, independent information, and especially how alone we are in the United States in the entire industrialized world in not guaranteeing a right for people to have access to health care. But this wasn't very convincing to him. He said, what else? So I said, I'm going to talk about the global economic meltdown. What else? Now, the thing is, I did want to come. I had a commitment here, and clearly this was not going to happen if we didn't go through the whole talk. I was thinking of inviting him, saying, well, you could actually hear the entire talk if you just want to come with me. I'd be talking about the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. What else? And I'm not sure really what he was getting at until he said, are you talking about the Olympics? Now, I'm embarrassed because, as some people know me know, I'm not a real sports fan. And I said that, well, you know, President Obama had gone to Copenhagen. Actually, it is a part of my talk for another reason, to push for the Olympics to come to Chicago. He said, yeah, but you didn't get it. I said, I know that. I know that. And he said, and what about the Olympics here in 2010? And now I was embarrassed because, you know, I could see what I would look like in the eyes of a Canadian, not even quite realizing you had gotten them. And so I said, well, I didn't He said, you know that we have the Olympics in 2010. I felt like I was confronting, you know, a football fan on a Sunday, and because I don't even know the difference between the teams. I said, actually, I'm embarrassed to say. I didn't quite, I mean, I know Brazil beat out the United States, but I felt, I couldn't tell if I was insulting him for his Canadian pride or if something else was going on, which I'm sure it was that something else that was going on. But he just wanted to know about my knowledge of the Olympics. So it took a little while. I don't know why it did, because my knowledge of the Olympics is exactly zero. But that seemed to get me in deeper water, that there was some denial going on. I'm, to say the least, very taken aback by what I just went through. Very shocked to be asked about what I was going to talk about. And to see my colleagues' computers being gone through and being told to go inside so that we wouldn't see what they're going through in our car. And I didn't even realize, you know, you don't need a visa coming from the United States into Canada, but, you know, taking our photographs and giving us these travel documents and saying we had to leave on Friday morning and we had to leave the country and be clear and show the Canadian authorities that we had left the country. But anyway, I am here, and I said, you know, there are a number of people who are waiting, and I realize at this point everything I say is information gathering. It's giving information over just to say people are waiting, just to say these radio stations are involved. And it's very important that we feel free to be able to speak in Canada, in the United States, because dissent is what will save us. We live in very dire times. Global warring, global warming, the global economic meltdown, the lack of health care in the United States. These are crises that need people other than those typical pundits we see on all the networks who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. We need people who think outside the box. Think of that TV screen as the box. Because when you have just those that know nothing punditocracy with the standard 8 or 9 second soundbite, what are you going to get in that amount of time? You just get the status quo reinforced. If you say Saddam Hussein was like Hitler, everyone knows every reference point. You've said it within a few seconds. You're ready for prime time. If you have something else to say, perhaps that, well, officials of our government of the United States were guilty of war crimes, that's actually, you can say that in less than 8 seconds. But you sound a little crazy. You're marginalized because you have to take a little time to explain what are the Nuremberg principles, what are the Geneva Conventions, what are war crimes. That takes more time. They say it's not a political edit. It's just that... you're not ready to concisely address the issue. We need to go beyond the way the issues have been framed. We see where the status quo has gotten us, and we can't afford this anymore. It is a supreme irony that President Obama will be going to Oslo to receive the Nobel Peace Prize just after he announces next week an escalation of the war in Afghanistan. Tens of thousands of more troops going to Afghanistan. These are the times in which we live. Until today, it wasn't clear he would be going to Copenhagen. He will now, apparently, right before he gets the Peace Prize. But the idea that all of this time with this absolutely critical issue that the most powerful person on earth would not say whether or not he would go, but would say that there will not be a binding agreement coming out of what some call the most important diplomatic summit in history. No, there won't be a binding agreement, and the Senate in our country has not passed climate change legislation. I dare say it has something to do with the oil, gas, and coal interests that have been pouring in something like $300,000 a day into the U.S. Congress lobbying on these issues, like the health insurance industry and big pharma, the pharmaceutical companies that are pouring more than $1 million a day into trying to ensure that the private health care system we have in the United States doesn't change. Now a House bill has just been introduced and passed, a Senate bill as well. The House bill simply guarantees that these insurance companies will get even richer. It's quite astounding. They put a little pressure on, and the government in the United States completely caves, because our political system, the electoral system, is marinated in, completely dependent on money. That's how it works. What I do know about 2010, even if I didn't know about the Olympics here in Canada, is that there are midterm elections in the United States, and that's what the Democrats and Republicans are gearing up for. And the people that they turn to, I should say the corporations that are considered people in the United States under law, are the ones that are lobbying to keep the system the way it is. That if you're poor in the United States, if you're a poor child born into a poor family, you don't have the right to have health care. It's an astounding story, and one of the most powerful countries in the world. You know, it would be easy in the United States. It's hard to explain to you here because you have such a different system. But actually, to fit into that 8-second soundbite, to somehow explain in the United States what single-payer system is, right? It's 1-1,000, 2-1,000, 3-1,000. Those are the seconds it would take. It's Medicare, our age of eligibility is 65, that where the age of eligibility is just dropped to zero. You know, everyone in the United States would have that care. But we have nothing like that. There are no socialist epithets hurled around in the United States when you talk about firefighters or police or the military or public education. But there are when you talk about health care. And it is a major battle in the United States, which is why I was pointing out to the border guards as we came here that it really is important to talk about Tommy Douglas at the Douglas border crossing where we were. This was the last column before the book was put together. Imagine the scene. America 2009, 45,000 people have died in a year, an average of well over 100 a day. Who's taking them out? Who's killing them? To investigate, Obama might be tempted to call on Jack Bauer. Do you know the program 24? You do. The fictional rogue intelligence agent from the hit TV series 24, the tortured torturer, who invariably employs torture and a host of other illegal tactics to help the president fight terrorism. But terrorism isn't the culprit here. It's lack of adequate health care. So maybe the president's solution isn't Jack Bauer, but rather the actor who plays him, Kiefer Sutherland. Now, you probably know more about Kiefer Sutherland and his ties to health care than most Americans know. Kiefer Sutherland, the grandson of Tommy Douglas, right? The son of Helen Douglas, the son of Donald Sutherland, the grandson of Tommy Douglas, the pioneering Canadian politician who's credited with creating the modern Canadian health care system. And then I tell the story of Tommy Douglas, which I'm sure you all know. But for us in the United States, the idea that Kiefer Sutherland would be tied to something as important as, you know, improving the health care of an entire population is extremely significant. What he's known for in the United States is 24. Even generals at West Point have tried to prevail upon the leaders at Fox to tone down the torture, because so many soldiers say that they watch 24. You know, soldiers who torture at Abu Ghraib, who torture at Guantanamo, at Bagram. And it matters. And imagine if someone like Kiefer Sutherland were to speak in the United States about health care. He spoke in Alberta in 2000. He said, private health care doesn't work. America's trying to change their system. It's too expensive to get comprehensive medical care in the U.S. Why on earth are we going to follow their system here? I consider it a humanitarian issue. This is an issue about what is right and wrong, what is decent and what is not. For you, this might not be a big deal, but Kiefer Sutherland said this here in Canada. But for him to make a statement like this in the United States would be extraordinary, because he addresses a very right-wing audience in the United States. Rush Limbaugh, 24, is one of his favorite shows. He's visited the set. I mean, for him to find out the true feelings of his hero, Jack Bauer, would be quite something. And, you know, Kiefer Sutherland was asked a while ago by a reporter, you know, how he'll fill his father, the actor Donald Sutherland's shoes. And he said, it's not my father I'm concerned about. It's my grandfather. Well, I think he could fill his grandfather's shoes if he just spoke up the way he speaks in Canada. Maybe Jack Bauer can save the day. So now, if the friends of the Border Guard are here, you see I was telling the truth. I was going to begin by talking about Tommy Douglas and his grandson. But healthcare is very much on my mind because I lost my mother a few weeks ago. My mom was a just tremendous woman. She was 79 years old. She was the picture of health. We thought my grandmother, her mother, had lived till 108, only died a few years ago, so we didn't have many concerns about my mother's health. She was trekking through the mountains of New Hampshire in August, but then she got a pain in her right side, went to the doctor, he said it's probably nothing. But I called him, and I said, if my mother complains, it's got to be something serious, and prevailed on him to really check her out. He did a CAT scan, and we learned that day that she had fourth-stage metastasized cancer. It was the end of August. My brothers and I went with her into the hospital, and for the next 5 weeks, we basically lived with her at a hospital called Mount Sinai in New York, considered one of the finest hospitals in the United States. It was like standing at the door as her sentries with loaded guns and a sign that said, do no harm. At first, we would go away at night and sleep at home, but we realized the care was so catastrophic that even to leave for a few hours was too risky. So I would leave from the hospital in the morning, rush off to do Democracy Now!, and then just come back to be with her. I mean, it's not just about lack of health insurance, the crisis of medical care in the United States. It's the whole way patients are perceived, the lack of understanding the body as one organic system. One example, the swallow specialist comes into the room, and she has with her yogurt and crackers. Now, my mother was on clears for weeks. She hadn't had solid food for weeks because the surgeon had put her on this diet, you know, water, apple juice, broth, tea. So I said, you must be in the room with the wrong patient. My mom can't have any of that. Meanwhile, my mom's eyes get wide. Yogurt? What kind of yogurt is that? She says. She says, oh, it's blueberry. And so I said, well, yeah, she isn't able to eat this. And so she said, no, we're going to test her swallow mechanism. I said, yeah, well, I mean, you could do that with water or tea, but she can't have yogurt or crackers. And she said, this isn't about the food. It's about the test of the swallowing. So I said, now, I am not, you know, I'm not a medical doctor, but I graduated from elementary school. And I know that if you swallow this, it's going to go somewhere. And she called in the doctor, and they told me to step aside. I couldn't control all of my mother's health care. And they made her swallow this, and she got deathly ill. And a few hours later, the surgeon comes in, knowing that we're controlling her care, and turns to me and says, what about clears? Don't you understand? I mean, the lack of communication between doctors as well. It is a completely broken system that has to be addressed from top to bottom. Especially when a person is approaching the end of life, the hero doctors don't know what to do and they just slowly desert you. I was sitting reading the Times one day near her, the op-ed page, and the advertorials, you know what they are, they're pioneered by companies like ExxonMobil, and they're made to look like articles on the editorial page, but in fact they're paid for by a company, they're just corporate propaganda. And I'm reading this piece by a woman named Dr. Diane Meyer. It says, the two things patients need most are time with their doctor. Seems they're moonwalking out of the room before they even ever make it in. And pain management, managing pain, that takes listening to the patient, paying attention, because pain actually makes you sicker. And I said to my mother, we've got to go to her hospital. But it said right there, Dr. Diane Meyer, Mount Sinai Hospital. We were in it. But it did lead us to discover this remarkable woman, this pioneer in palliative care, that helped us transition to the last days that my mother had with us. I mean, those 5 weeks were, in one way, a remarkable time for us to be able to show our devotion to my mother in a way that she had showed us all our lives. But we were not able to do what she had done with us all our lives, and that was protect her the way she had protected us. Coming out of a surgery, she's laying in the recovery room. Everyone else is unconscious. She never seemed to be unconscious at any point in the hospital. And she's laying there, and we're around her, and she's saying, 3,000, 3,000. 3,000 what, Mom? 3,000 what? 3,000, 3,000. And the doctor comes closer. 3,000 what, Mrs. Goodman? She said, the Chinese figured out pain management 3,000 years ago. Why haven't you figured it out? Dr. Meyer taught us about the conversations you have, how you say goodbye, five things you want to say. Thank you, forgive me, I forgive you, I love you, and goodbye. And how, when a person is dying, how to deal with, my mother had so many friends that were like family who wanted to come, and yet she was so sick. And she said, why don't you have them write letters, not get well soon letters, but really about their lives together, their experiences, and what it meant to them. And to sit at her bedside with people writing from all over, emailing us, and us reading those letters. And she would say, oh, I remember that. Oh, is that how he felt about that? And it was truly a gift from everyone. And then the grandchildren, how do we bring them to her? What would be their last memories of her? Would this be too traumatic? You know, Jasper, who's 10, and Eli, who's 11, and Sarah, who's 12, and Ariel, who's 17, Anna, who's 22. But in the end, we decided my mother was, you know, radiant. She was transcendent, and that this would be important for them to be there and say goodbye. And Eli came, he's 11, and he composed a symphony for her on his computer, and he played it for her. Ariel wrote a letter about her Ima and how important she was in her life. And Anna, who's going to be going to medical school, has a beautiful voice and sang her at last full throttle in the hospital. Jasper, who's 10, just said, I love you. And my mother talked to them. First, of course, saying, how was your day? What are you doing? Because that's what was most important to her. She was in their lives all the time. And then she said, you know, to Jasper, he's a big Red Sox fan. That I know about sports is Red Sox. I'll be with you at Fenway, you know, when he comes down from Vermont to see the games. And to Ariel, who wants to go to college and is a great soccer player, I'm with you at every game. And to Anna, she'll be with her at Grand Rounds. And so at my mom's funeral, I read this poem that I read for my dad as well. Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I'm a thousand winds that blow. I'm the diamond glints on snow. I'm the sunlight on ripened grain. I'm the gentle autumn rain. When you awaken in the morning's hush, I am the swift uplifting rush of quiet birds in circling flight. I'm the soft star that shines at night. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die. My mom was a remarkable woman. She taught women's history and literature at local community colleges in the 1970s. You know, cops and firefighters and I guess customs guards, civil servants, would all take her courses because they'd get a higher salary if they got more credits. And so what could be easier than a little Czech lit course, right? Czech literature. And she would be introducing them to Virginia Woolf and to Toni Morrison. And soon they'd be bringing their wives and their daughters. It was a time of really the blossoming of women's liberation, and they would be understanding what their loved ones were going through. By the end of the semester, the room would just swell with whole families. And then my mother decided to go back to social work school to get a degree in clinical social work to work with families. She was incredibly inquisitive, curious, to the end, as my father was. When my friends would come over, my brother's friends would come over, we considered it them giving the third degree and begged them not to do it. But for them to have a conversation, to ask our friends, you know, what they're doing, what their thoughts are, what they plan to do, what they wanted to be. And I would say, I'm so sorry, it's just my mom and dad. And they'd say, wow, that's love. And that's really what it was. And they lived it with each other and with us all of our lives. They protected us in a cocoon, but they also felt it was absolutely, we get, absolutely critical, we get out there in the world. And that's how they lived their lives. Deep love of literature, of film and documentary as a way to understand other cultures if they weren't going to the places themselves. Even when my dad died 10 years ago, my mother continued as an intrepid traveler to Iran, to Turkey, to Vietnam, to Laos, Cambodia, to Israel, to Palestine. My parents met at Hebrew-speaking camp, and they weren't allowed to speak English. They went to camp with Noam Chomsky and Carol, his wife. Noam and Carol knew each other since they were 2 years old, you know, in Philadelphia. And they weren't allowed to speak English. My dad and Noam were bunkmates. My father would always say, how's Noam Chomsky? I'd say, Dad, it's Chomsky. He's a linguist. So, and to show how complex my mother was, 1 year she was voted funniest camper, the next year most serious. You know, they had been to Israel a number of times, as we had with them. But my mother also felt it was critical to go to Palestine, to the occupied territory. She went with a group, with a human rights delegation, taken around by a Palestinian tour guide. And I can't even ask her now, was it Bethlehem, was it Jericho, where they were supposed to go through this checkpoint? And the Palestinian guide thought he'd worked it out with the soldiers. But when he went up to them, of course, they said, you can't go through. And then my mother stepped forward. She speaks a kind of classical Hebrew because they learned it like decades ago. It's like Shakespearean English, I think. But she went up, and who knows what it is she said in Hebrew, but something like, you will part the ways. And these soldiers separated, and they allowed the whole group to go through. And that Palestinian tour guide put his arm around my mother, and he said, I'm sticking with you. And that has been my philosophy my whole life. When my mother was young, her family was very poor. My grandfather was an Orthodox rabbi. He ran the local yeshiva in Brooklyn, New York. And they would get out of the city heat by going to a bungalow colony in the Catskills in the summer. And my mother told me this summer that she was out playing, and she heard this wail go up in the colony, and it was her mother, my grandmother. She'd gotten a letter that said a number of her relatives had died in the Holocaust. And what we got from that, both of my parents, what they taught us in everything that we do, we lived in the shadow of the Holocaust. We understood what it meant for so many, the horror, is that this can never happen to anyone, anywhere again. Never again to anyone, anywhere. And that's how they lived their lives, and their pursuit of social justice for everyone as leading peace activists in our community. And that's what they expected of us. Yes, a cocoon at home, but that we had a responsibility to go out in the world, never again, for anyone, anywhere. In the last days of my mother's life, Breaking the Sound Barrier came out, and I was able to bring it to her and put it on the bedside table and open it to the dedication page to my mom, Dari Bach Goodman, the most remarkable woman I have ever known. So going from health care to other issues, health care to global warming, to global warring, Afghanistan, the idea that the war is now going to escalate under President Obama. I mean, there is no question that what happened on Election Day in the United States was historic, was a truly global event. Barack Hussein Obama being elected president, the first African-American president, with the history we have of slavery in the United States, among other things. I remember when, after he was elected, but before he took office, he and Michelle Obama were invited to the White House by the Bushes, and CNN invited me to come on to comment on the moment. It was in the afternoon, and there was some chatter going on about other things, and I saw on the video them going into the White House. And they asked me about something else, but I said, wait a second, we have to take pause. Barack Hussein Obama, Michelle LaVon Robinson Obama. Her grandfather came from South Carolina, the direct descendant of slaves. So their children as well, Sasha and Malia, are the descendants of slaves. And they are going to reside in the White House, the most famous house on earth, built by slaves. Let's just take a pause. Can Barack Obama redeem the White House? Well, it is not just up to him. I do think that people have felt they've hit their heads against a brick wall for many years now. And that wall has become a door. And the door has been opened a crack. But whether it will be kicked open or slammed shut is not up to that one person. It's up to everyone else. And he, Obama, more than anyone else, understands the power of community organizing. Right? He's the community organizer-in-chief. He's just become the commander-in-chief. The good thing is parents all over will be saying to their kids, maybe you can be a community organizer too. But that means, as Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, said, power concedes nothing without a demand. And when those who walk the West Wing of the White House, who are used to having the ear of the most powerful person on earth, whisper their demands in his ear, if he can't point out the window of the Oval Office and say, if I do that, they will storm the Bastille, he'll be in big trouble, especially if there's no one out there. So sometimes it means supporting him, but many times it may well mean taking a different position than the person so many elected in the United States and held out great hope in. The mantle has been passed on, and people have to figure out how to community organize when that community organizer has become the commander-in-chief. It's a very serious issue on so many different issues. Just announced he will go to Copenhagen. That's very significant, and that had to come out of tremendous pressure. Even that he put off the decision for escalating the war came from serious divisions in the ranks of the White House, though ultimately he decided to go that route. What soldiers and veterans are going through, just back for a moment on the issue of health care, Harvard Medical School did a study recently, and we did it on Democracy Now! On Veterans Day, when that study was released, that said 4 times as many U.S. Army veterans died last year because they lacked health insurance than the total number of U.S. soldiers who were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's just amazing. A research team at Harvard Medical School says more than 2,200 vets died under the age of 65 in 2008 because they were uninsured. But I want to talk about another kind of help of soldiers. A few weeks ago, at Fort Hood, the biggest Army base in the United States, there was this mass killing, 13 people killed, more than 30 wounded. A number, though, that isn't talked about very much is the number of suicides in the U.S. military right now. A few weeks ago, I met a couple named Greg and Janet Kiesling. They're a couple from Indianapolis. Their son is Chance Kiesling. U.S. Army Reserve Specialist Chancellor Kiesling died in Iraq on June 19th from a non-combat-related incident, so said the Pentagon. Chance Kiesling killed himself. He was just one in what's turning out to be a record number year for suicides in the U.S. military. In August, President Obama addressed the Convention of Veterans of Foreign Wars. He said there's nothing more sobering than signing a letter of condolence to the family of a serviceman or woman who's given their life for our country. Well, to their surprise, Janet and Greg Kiesling will not be receiving a letter of condolence from President Obama. because he doesn't write condolence letters to loved ones of those who commit suicide in the theater of combat. He's just following in the footsteps of President Bush. Janet, Chance's mother, told me, Chancellor was recruited right out of high school. This was something he was passionate about, joining the military. I wanted him to go to college, but he said he wanted to be a soldier. His dad, Greg, said, we had doubts about him joining when the war broke out in 2003, when many of us were trying to retreat. Chancey decided, this is my duty. But once he did his first tour, his marriage broke up during that deployment, and Chance fell apart. By all accounts, he performed admirably as a soldier, but at one point he was put on a suicide watch and they took his ammunition away for a week. After Iraq, Chance declined tens of thousands of dollars in a reenlistment bonus. He knew he had to get his life together. He transitioned to the U.S. Army Reserves. He sought help and got treatment at a Veterans Affairs facility. But then, his dad said, we sat down with his family, said, President Obama's going to be elected. He'll end this war. You won't have to go. But his son's orders to deploy came again, and he was immediately sent back to Iraq. They got an email from him mentioning suicide. His mother talked to Chance. She said it was a very tough conversation. He said he would have a very difficult day the next day. His conversation brief. Normally he would say he loves me and he would say goodbye, but this time he just hung up. Greg, his dad, said the next morning, Chance locked himself in the latrine and took his own life with his M4. He said, our grief is deep, Greg said. The letter won't stop our pain, but we'll still be hollow inside for the rest of our lives. The acknowledgement, though, from the president that our son gave his life in service to the causes of the United States is important to us. The Kieslings credit Major General Mark Graham with helping them through their grief and trying to reduce the stigma of suicide within the military. One of General Graham's sons committed suicide in 2003 while studying as an Army ROTC cadet in college. His other son, soon after, was sent to Iraq. He was in the Army, and he was killed by a bomb. The United States is engaged in two intractable, massive military occupations with no end in sight. Obama should certainly write letters of condolence to the Kieslings and to others whose loved ones have found that the only sure way to end the living hell of war or to escape the horror of its aftermath is to kill themselves. But an immediate withdrawal from the wars Obama inherited is the only way to stem the bleeding. The war and the effects that it has, and the people who speak up, these are the voices that have to be heard, and rarely are they heard in the military. The level of resistance in the military is remarkable. All over the United States, thousands of people refusing to go to the war. The figures are from the Pentagon, but they don't like to talk about it. The group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org in New York, a media watch group, did a study of the 2 weeks around Colin Powell, then Secretary of State in 2003, giving his push for war at the UN, February 5th, 2003. They looked at the four major nightly newscasts in the United States, NBC Nightly News, ABC World News Tonight, CBS Evening News, and the PBS, the Public Broadcasting News Hour, with Jim Lehrer. It's like your Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Those four nightly newscasts over 2 weeks had 393 interviews done around war. This is like 5 weeks before the invasion. You know, when, as Noam Chomsky says, the media is manufacturing consent for war. 393 interviews done. Guess how many were with anti-war leaders? None is an underestimate. Three of almost 400. None was close. This is a time when half the population in the United States was opposed to war. I mean, those who are opposed to war, those who are opposed to torture, are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take it back. Someone asked me recently, what do I think of the mainstream media? I think it would be a good idea. Yeah. I mean, it's such a critical point. Conservative Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Liberals, Greens, come together on a number of issues like privacy, corporate control, yes, even war, and certainly torture. And yet the media presents none of this common ground. And it's absolutely critical. I don't know the struggles you have in Canada around the issue of independent media, but I see the media as the most powerful institutions on earth, more powerful than any bomb, more powerful than any missile. And is an idea that explodes on the scene, shatters paradigms, that comes from hearing and watching and listening to people, working with people, being the people yourselves who think outside the box, because we can't afford what has been said over and over again in the mainstream media or the corporate media today. I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day, war and peace, life and death. Anything less than that is a disservice to the servicemen and women of our country. They can't have these debates on military bases. They rely on us in civilian society to have the discussions that lead to the decisions about whether they live or die, about whether they are sent to kill or be killed. Anything less than that is a disservice to a democratic society. We begin standing up, breaking the sound barrier, with a column right around the time that Colin Powell spoke at the United Nations in front of the UN Security Council. There's this famous painting that I'm sure many of you know by Pablo Picasso, Guernica, about the Spanish, it portrays the Spanish town that was bombed during the Franco years. And it shows the agony of war in the faces of the people and the animals. Well, there is a replica of that painting in front of the UN Security Council, a tapestry that hangs there. And it has really become an anti-war symbol around the world. Well, in that lead-up to the invasion, with people like Colin Powell pushing for war, he later called his speech a stain on his career, they shrouded the tapestry. Because, you know, at the UN and even the US officials understood to have this anti-war statement as the backdrop of their pro-war pronouncements, so they closed a blue curtain over it. It's our job to pull those curtains back. It's essential to making decisions about where we want to go. You know, President Obama has condemned torture, and that was very significant. I mean, first day in office, he's going to close Guantanamo in a year, and now they've concluded they can't do that. But he did condemn torture, and that was significant. He didn't condemn extraordinary rendition, which you know very well in Canada. Maher Arar, the Canadian citizen taken out of JFK and sent off to Syria, where he was tortured and interrogated, held in a grave-like cell for 10 months and 10 days, returned to Canada a broken man. Canadian government judicial commission does an investigation, awards him, ultimately the government awards him $10 million, still on a terror watch list in the United States, can't enter. When he testifies before Congress, he does it by video. He was the victim of, well, extraordinary rendition is really just CIA speak for kidnapping. And just recently in Italy, several dozen U.S. CIA operatives were convicted in absentia for kidnapping a Muslim sheikh off the streets of Milan. They are now fugitives, international fugitives. These CIA operatives, including a station chief there, can't go to Europe without possibly being arrested. President Obama has not condemned extraordinary rendition, and it should be. While he has condemned torture, he still will not have released a number of photographs of torture. And I think this is just like showing the images of war, a serious mistake. It's not the photographs, it's the practice that's the problem. And as soon as people see them, they'll know what they want to happen, and that's the practice to stop, and that's what's most important. Could you imagine if for just 1 week we saw the images of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, the women with their legs blown off by cluster bombs, babies dead on the ground, soldiers dead and dying, for just 1 week? Americans are a compassionate people. They would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. That's the power of the image. That's the power of telling the truth about horrific situations. The power is you can transform that But you need to know. And that is the power of the media. You know, information is power. I go to this independent coffee shop in New York. It's in this old brick building, and there's a plaque on the outside of it that says, this is the place where Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, took refuge when he first came to New York from being enslaved in Maryland. He came to this place that was the printing press of a free black man named David Ruggles. And I think it's so interesting that Ruggles, a great abolitionist, Douglass, a great abolitionist, who started the North Star newspaper, both saw media as their form of liberation. And that's because information is power. It is that important. And speaking of Frederick Douglass, and I may have mentioned this story before, but I just see it as such an important one. When I saw Obama, the Obamas, entering the White House, the idea of the possibility of could this White House be redeemed, I thought of another house hours away in Maryland on the Eastern Shore. Frederick Douglass, the enslaved, ultimately great abolitionist of our time, was enslaved as a youth and a teenager and taken to this property in St. Michael's in Maryland, given to a man named Edwin Covey, who was a slave breaker. He dealt with the troublesome slaves. So, no surprise, Frederick Douglass was handed to him. And he beat him, he tortured Frederick Douglass. But Frederick Douglass eventually escaped and headed north. That property was called Mount Misery. It is today owned by Donald Rumsfeld. He bought it in 2003 when he was defense secretary to be near his close friend, Vice President Dick Cheney. When I learned of this, I thought we have to really check this out. As journalists, you know, we can't go with the rumor mill of the internet, though there seemed to be a lot of information to back it up. So Dennis and I headed down to St. Michael's. And when we got there, I realized I have no idea where the Secretary of Defense lives. How am I going to check this out? But there was this organic coffee shop that we came up on. You could see a theme in my life. And I thought, they'll tell the truth. So I went inside, and they said, what would you like? I said, I'd like to know where the Secretary of Defense lives. And they said, oh, you just go out back, and you go down the road. You'll hit Mount Pleasant Road. Don't go down that road. And then you make a right, and you make another right, and then you'll hit Mount Misery Road. And you go down that road, and he lives at the end of the street. So we went out back, we drove down the road, we didn't go down Mount Pleasant Road, and we made a right, and then another right. We couldn't go right enough, but we did finally hit Mount Misery Road, and we went down that road, and as we got to the end of it, we saw the Secret Service vehicle, the black-tinted windows, and I got out and started filming. And as I was zooming in, they were zooming out. And I was wondering, does Donald Rumsfeld know the significance of this property? But sure enough, as I was zooming in, I see the stake in the ground that says Mount Misery. I went over to this old black church. It was Sunday in this dusty road, and went in, and the old folks were having Sunday school right before the Mass. And I went up to a woman. I said, what do you think of this? I mean, this historic place. Frederick Douglass was enslaved here. He fought back. He left. He was enslaved at Mount Misery. Donald Rumsfeld, who's known for torture around the world, now owns Mount Misery. What do you make of this? And she said, I can't comment. We're in church now. But from Mount Misery to Mount Hope, I was speaking in Geneva, New York, upstate New York. And a young woman came up to me after and said, listen, I want to take you to the gravestone of Frederick Douglass at Mount Hope Cemetery in Rochester. It was a very snowy night, and I was leaving early the next morning. I said, I'll meet you at 5 in the morning. And there she was, and she took me through the cemetery, and we brushed off the snow of the tombstone of Frederick Douglass. And then she got a twinkle in her eye and said, come with me across the cemetery. I'd like to show you one more tombstone. And I went with her, and there was the tombstone of Susan B. Anthony, the great suffragette, the great women's rights activist. She's buried next to her sister. Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass weren't just allies. They were close friends. Susan B. Anthony was not only a women's rights advocate, but an abolitionist. And Frederick Douglass was a great feminist. He'd been to the Women's Rights Convention at Seneca Falls in 1848. Feminism, women's rights, the civil rights movement, the abolitionist movement, these are the movements that have made our country great. And we need a media that reflects these movements. It's not just about individuals who crop up, who come out of nowhere and are just alone. It is absolutely critical, especially young people, see the way history is made. It also makes it easier. How can one person shoulder all the responsibility? But to know how people have done it in the past is so important.
You are listening to Amy Goodman at the Vancouver Public Library on November 25, 2009. The event was a benefit for nonprofit radio, namely CJSF, CFRO, and CITR. This recording was made for CFRO Co-op Radio by Alex Smith. Let's get back to the speech.
These movements are the kind of movements that we read very little about unless, for example, kids get Howard Zinn in high school or college, and he is not a standard textbook in the United States. But in Breaking the Sound Barrier, we have a number of stories of people who do stand up. They don't make it to the mainstream media, but they stop, they make an enormous difference. And in this time of the crises we face, I think it's always important to hear about some of the things they do. Like, for example, a kid named Tim DeChristopher. Tim DeChristopher was a student at the University of Utah, an economics student. He had just finished his final exam. It was last December. And one of the exam questions was, if the oil and gas companies are the only ones who bid on public lands, are the true costs of oil and gas exploitation reflected in the prices paid? He was inspired. Tim finished his exam, threw on his red parka, and went off to the controversial Bureau of Land Management land auction that the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance called the Bush administration's last great gift to the oil and gas industry. Instead of joining the protest outside, he went inside. He went to check out what is a land auction all about, and he sees they weren't bonding the bidders, so he picked up Paddle 70 and started to bid for land. He ended up buying 22,000 acres. Yes, he successfully bid on the public properties located near the Arches and Canyonlands National Parks and Dinosaur National Monument and other pristine areas. The price tag, more than $1.8 million. Which he didn't happen to have in his wallet at the time. He got arrested for what he did. Then the former director of the Bureau of Land Management took him on as his client. He represents him now. Never assume who your opponents are. We live in very extreme times, and I think conservative and liberal lines are breaking down in many ways. Patrick Shea, this former director of the Bureau of Land Management, told the Deseret News, what Tim did was in the best tradition of civil disobedience. He did this without causing any physical or material harm. His purpose was to draw attention to the illegitimacy and immorality of the process. There's a long tradition of disrupting land development in Utah. In his memoir, Desert Solitaire, Edward Abbey, the writer and activist, wrote, "Wilderness, the word itself is music. We scarcely know what we mean by the term, though the sound of it draws all whose nerves and emotions have not yet been irreparably stunned, deadened, numbed by the caterwauling of commerce, the sweating scramble for profit and domination." Edward Abbey's novel, The Monkey Wrench Gang, inspired a generation of environmental activists to take direct action, disrupting so-called development. As the Salt Lake Tribune reported on Tim DeChristopher, he didn't pour sugar into a bulldozer's gas tank. He didn't spike a tree or set a billboard on fire. But wielding only a bidder's paddle, a University of Utah student just as surely monkey-wrenched a federal oil and gas lease sale Friday, ensuring that thousands of acres near two southern Utah national parks won't be open to drilling anytime soon. Now, the latest on Tim DeChristopher is he was arrested under the Bush administration. And then under the Obama administration, they put off the auction under Bush. They had to. He nullified the whole thing because he drove up the prices. The land he didn't get, he drove up the prices because he kept bidding on it for the oil and gas companies. And then he bought the number, the 22,000 acres he did. So it put off the auction. And under Obama, they said they're not going to auction it off. That's a very good thing. But under Obama, he was charged with a number of felonies, and he faces many years in prison. And last week, he lost round one of his court case. The judge said he could not use global warming as his defense. He was going to bring in one of the great climatologists, Jim Hansen, who heads the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, the NASA climatologist, who himself just got arrested in Virginia protesting mountaintop removal for coal mining. And so that leaves Tim is just going into this auction and fraudulently, you know, buying up all this land. But as Patrick Shea said, it won't be the first time someone claims they have money when they don't. Which leads me on the issue of the environment and others to the Yes Men. How many of you know who the Yes Men are? A much more educated audience than many in the United States. But I was just with them a few weeks ago. Were they recently here? I was with them a few weeks ago in the New York Public Library because they were being given an award by Creative Time, which is an artist group. The Yes Men. Well, for the few of you who don't know, you know, they're this, they stage these elaborate hoaxes on global trade organizations, multinational corporations, and politicians. They satirically skewer corporate free trade pro-business positions by acting as genuine, sincere spokes jerks for these institutions. So a few weeks ago, you know about their action at the National Press Club right around Halloween. They posed as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and they held a news conference, and they said the chamber would reverse its historically adamant opposition to climate change legislation. But let me give you a little background. You know about what they did in 2004. Actually, in a week, we're going to hit the 25th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster. You know, the Union Carbide plant, the gas leak that killed thousands, hundreds of thousands are still injured. Well, 5 years ago on the 20th anniversary, they set up this website. I think it was called DowEthics.com. And the BBC emailed them and invited them on the show on the BBC to talk about, you know, their response to what happened in Bhopal as Dow. It's a little surprising that they emailed them at Dow Ethics. Wasn't that a red flag in itself? But anyway, they did. And Andy Bechtolbaum went on BBC. He was in an insert studio in Paris where he lived, and the BBC news anchor was in London. And he took on the name Jude Finisterra, Finisterra, end of the earth. And the interview began. And, you know, the news anchor on BBC said, Mr. Finisterra is the representative of Dow. What do you say about Bhopal? You know, Dow had bought Union Carbide. And he said, we are terribly sorry. We apologize to the people of Bhopal. And as we speak, we are liquidating Union Carbide. And we will give the $12 billion to the suffering people of Bhopal. So suddenly on BBC, it's breaking news. And the news anchor is saying, wait, are you saying you're going to give this to the people of Bhopal? He said, the suffering people of Bhopal, yes. So this goes on for 5 minutes, and the interview ends, and Dow calls BBC enraged, says, you've been hoaxed, and the red-faced BBC has to go on and say that it wasn't true what happened, right? And the Yes Men did not skip a beat. They immediately issued a press release under Dow Ethics that said, we do not apologize to the people of Bhopal, and we will not compensate them for the suffering that we caused 20 years ago. So, yeah, that's the Yes Men. And then you probably heard about what they did in 2007, addressing Canada's largest oil conference, posing as executives of ExxonMobil and the National Petroleum Council, announcing a plan to convert the corpses of the expected millions of victims of climate change into a fuel they called Vivoleum. They were ejected, and Mike Bonanno told the press, while ExxonMobil continues to post record profits, they use their money to persuade governments to do nothing about climate change. This is a crime against humanity. That's the background. So a few weeks ago, they hold this news conference at the National Press Club. I think it cost them $500 to rent the room. And it was Andy Bechtolbaum who read from the statement, we at the Chamber have tried to keep climate science from interfering with business, but without a stable climate, there will be no business, he said. Fox Business News went live. to the National Press Club. Breaking news, breaking news. CNBC follows. Reuters picks it up. Other global media outlets carry the story of the chamber's surprise support for climate change legislation. During the news conference, a real representative of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce came in absolutely irate, demanding the ID of the fake spokesperson for the Chamber of Commerce, and Andy Biglebaumke said, "You give me your ID," and he's shouting, "You give me your ID." But of course, since he's there, it exposes him to questions from the audience about the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's position on climate change. A number of major corporations have pulled out of the chamber because of their opposition to climate change legislation, like Apple, Exelon, PG&E, and Levi Strauss. Well, we had on the next day Andy Biglebaum. We did the news conference. Go to it at democracynow.org. And we had on this career public relations executive from your country, Jim Hogan, who just wrote this piece, the book called Climate Cover-Up, The Crusade to Deny Global Warming. He said on Democracy Now!, the PR stunt wasn't pulled off by the yes men. The PR stunt is basically being pulled off by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and it's been going on for decades. Hogan's book describes what he calls a two-decade-long campaign by the energy industry in Canada and the U.S., basically designed to confuse the public about climate change and to give people the sense that there's a debate about the science of climate change. October 24th was this global day of action. Over 5,000 events happened around the world. That was sponsored by 350.org. You know, the group, it's named for what the scientists have identified as a sustainable target for carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere, 350 parts per million. We're at 387 ppm right now. Among the actions, President Mohamed Nasheed of the Republic of Maldives held an underwater cabinet meeting, donning scuba gear and literally meeting in 20 feet of water in the world's lowest lying country. The entire cabinet of the Maldives met underwater, except for, I think, two members of the parliament who don't know how to scuba dive. They signed an SOS from the frontline declaration, reading in part, "If we can't save the Maldives today, you can't save the rest of the world tomorrow." He's going to take this declaration to Copenhagen. And Democracy Now! Is going to be there. We're going to go there next Friday. We'll be covering the conference, what's happening in the streets, what's happening in the suites for 2 weeks to really bring out the voices of people from around the world who do go and who don't go around this critical issue, whether or not the world leaders pass any kind of binding resolution. I think there is a critical mass that is developing around the country. And especially in this 10th anniversary of the Battle of Seattle, it's important to recognize the power of grassroots action. 10 years ago, high school kids, I was just in Astoria, Oregon, yesterday or this morning, a 27-year-old woman came to me, she said, "I was 17 when I sat down in the streets of Seattle." She said, "It was my proudest moment. I went with my friend." High school kids, college kids, union activists, artists, farmers from around the world, doctors, nurses, activists from all over, recognizing the effect of unbridled capitalism, unregulated capitalism, and what it means. And, you know, we see exactly what was in store 10 years later. The high school kids were the prescient ones, were the ones who knew, were the ones we can all learn from. I just want to end sort of where I began, on the issue of control and the chilling effect on dissent when that control is exerted. Yesterday I was in Olympia, Washington, and one of the people in the audience was Brendan Maslauskas Dunn. He's a young activist and anarchist in Olympia who, in the last months, applied to the city of Olympia to find out what the police had on the anarchists, SDS, Iraq Veterans Against the War, a group called Port Militarization Resistance. They, you know, do civil disobedience to stop the Stryker vehicles from going to Iraq and Afghanistan that are sent off in the ships in the port of Olympia. And he ended up getting hundreds of documents. And among the documents he got was an email that deeply disturbed him about a guy named John J. Towery. And he quickly recognized that this guy, John J. Towery, was actually their friend, a close ally, an activist, an anarchist, they thought, their friend John Jacob. And they realized from these documents that actually he was a military spy from Fort Lewis. Extremely unnerving, not just a person they see at their meetings. Oh, you know, like in Fresno a few years ago, there was a guy who would come in and he would take notes from beginning to end, sort of like the notes the border guard was taking on me today as I was talking about Tommy Douglas tonight. I said that's D-O-U-G-L. But in Fresno, this guy came in and he would just take notes, so much that you think, well, that's not going to be the person because it's so obvious, you know, what he's doing. But he came to all of their meetings, and this was in Fresno. And a while later, they saw an obituary in the paper. He's a young guy. And it said that this police officer had died in a motorcycle accident. A guy with a totally different name, except they recognized the photograph. It was the guy in their peace group. And this has been happening all over the country. And the column I did on Brendan in Olympia, it didn't call it Bush's military is spying on U.S. peace groups, but Obama's military is spying on peace groups. And this is extremely serious. So they realize that John J. Towery II is actually their friend John Jacob, or their friend John Jacob is actually this guy from Fort Lewis. And they have found these documents that were the government did not want released. And the infiltration is in direct violation of the Posse Comitatus Act, preventing U.S. military deployment for domestic law enforcement. And now members of Congress are calling for a thorough investigation, like we had in the 70s in the United States under the Church Committee, investigating the assassination of foreign leaders, the spying on peace activists. And the question is, will that happen? Just recently, the protests in Pittsburgh of the G20, the group of 20. We talked to a young man, a social worker, who went to be a part of the protests. Thousands of people were protesting the same thing that people were protesting 10 years ago at the Battle of Seattle. This social worker from New York, arrested in Pittsburgh, then subjected to an FBI raid, all for using Twitter. Elliot Madison faced charges of hindering apprehension or prosecution, criminal use of a communication facility, possession of instruments of crime. He was posting to a Twitter feed, or tweeting, as it's called. He was tweeting publicly available information about police activities around the G20 protests, including information about where police had issued orders to disperse. Now, while alerting people to public information may not seem to be an arrestable offense, be forewarned, many have been arrested for the same crime in Iran. Last June 20th, as Iranians protested against the conduct and results of their national elections, President Obama said in a statement, "The universal rights to assembly and free speech must be respected, and the United States stands with all those who seek to exercise those rights." His statement was released in English, in Farsi, in Arabic, and posted on the White House's very own Twitter feed. The presidential tweet read, "We call on the Iranian government to stop all violent and unjust actions against its own people." The U.S. State Department even weighed in, impressed with the importance of Twitter to the Iranian protests, asked Twitter to delay system maintenance that might have interrupted the service during the Iranian protests. So Elliot Madison actually was encouraged. He said, maybe the State Department will weigh in on my behalf as well. When he went home after he was arrested, he, his wife, his roommates were roused from sleep during the weekend when the Joint Terrorism Task Force swept into their house, handcuffed them for hours, searched the house, and removed computers and other property from everyone in the house. Madison said the FBI for 16 hours proceeded to take everything from plush toys to kitchen magnets and lots of books. Rather than encourage and support the use of distributed, decentralized social networks to strengthen our democracy and dissent, the government seems headed in the opposite direction. William Bratton, who's the police chief of L.A., has just launched iWatch L.A., described as a community awareness program. But really, the iWatch program, despite Bratton's assertions, is about spying on your neighbors and turning them into the police. Well, back to the Iranian protests and a Twitterer in Iran for the virtual news hub Tehran Bureau, who wrote in an essay about the June protests, an officer spoke to us through a loudspeaker, "Disperse, this is your last warning. The sight of them made my knees tremble, but the wave pushed on and so I went along. He was beaten, bloodied, arrested, and held for 20 days, while Elliot Madison was not physically harmed. His case could prove central to the future of free speech in the mobile digital age." After he was interviewed on Democracy Now!, I mean, the case was so ludicrous, ultimately the charges were dropped. I think it was just humiliating to the U.S. government as it was exposed. But they didn't drop it without saying the authorities could reopen this case again, and that's the chill. And so I want to end going back to the Republican convention. Yes, hundreds of activists were arrested, and also more than 40 reporters were arrested at the Republican convention. It took place in St. Paul last August, a year ago. Among the reporters arrested were my colleagues, Sharif Abdelkadous, our senior producer at Democracy Now!, and Nicole Salazar, our multimedia producer. We were all just covering the protest the first day of the convention. The convention starts in the afternoon, mass protest in the morning against war in Iraq and Afghanistan, from the city hall in St. Paul to the convention center, led by soldiers, some in full military uniform, other vets. And, you know, they face serious repercussions for doing this. And, of course, many civilians, thousands of people marched. And we covered this. Then I went to the convention floor to interview delegates from the hottest state, from Alaska. And Sharif and Nicole and other Democracy Now! Producers went off to the offices to digitize tape. But they heard a commotion outside, and they ran down to cover what was happening. All I know is I got a call on my cell phone that Nicole and Sharif had been arrested. So I raced to 7th and Jackson in St. Paul. There was a big parking lot, and the riot police had surrounded the area. You know, I'm coming from the convention floor. I had my credentials around my neck. They could see I'd just come from there. And I raced up to the riot police. They had the area under full control. And I said, "I want to speak to your commanding officer. You can see I've just come from the convention. I'm fully credentialed. Two of our reporters are inside. They, too, are fully credentialed. We need to have them released." And it wasn't seconds before they ripped me through the police line, twisted my arms back, slapped the handcuffs on, pushed me to the ground, and arrested me for misdemeanor. Oh, the Border Patrol today wanted to know my arrest record, and then the details of what do you mean they arrested you at the Republican convention. But so I'll just say clearly what took place. They ripped me through the line, handcuffed me, charged me with misdemeanor, saying I had interfered with a peace officer. If only there was a peace officer there. I'm looking desperately for Sharif and Nicole because I heard they've been hurt. I couldn't find Nicole anywhere, but I saw Sharif across the parking lot, his hands behind his back. He was handcuffed. His arm was bloodied, his credentials around his neck. I demanded to be brought to him. Finally, they brought me to him. We're both standing there, our hands behind our back, handcuffed, with our credentials, saying, "You can see we're credentialed. We demand to be released as journalists." Whereupon the Secret Service came, and they ripped the credentials from around our necks. So I'm brought into the police wagon, and Nicole is there. Her face is bleeding. She's got her credentials around her neck. She's handcuffed. And she described what had happened, how they had come down to cover what was happening outside of the TV studio we were working out of, she and Sharif. She had the camera. He had the microphone. They were filming. Police, riot police came at them in formation. They were shouting at them, "On your face, on your face." Nicole was filming, and she was holding up her press pass and saying, "Press, press." And they took her down on her face, knee or boot in her back, dragging on her leg, which bloodied her face. And the first thing they did as her camera tumbled down was to pull the battery out of her camera. If you were wondering what it was, they didn't want to happen. Sharif is a very cool guy, very calm. He was urging the police to calm down, and they took him, threw him up against the wall, kicked him twice in the chest, and took him down, bloodying his arm and handcuffing him. They faced felony riot charges. So I was taken off to the police garage where the protest cages were erected. They were taken off to jail. If it weren't for Twitter and YouTube and email, and all other forms of decentralized independent communication, I don't think we would have been released after the number of hours we were. I mean, the YouTube video of our arrest went viral. It was up, I think, within a half an hour, and the response was enormous. The first 2 days of the convention, it was the most watched YouTube video. And I don't know how many hundreds of calls, emails, tweets, whatever the authorities got, but they released us to show its power. Sharif was in a cell with an AP photographer. He was not released when Sharif was released. So then I'm taken off to the convention because some networks wanted to talk to me. And I was in the NBC skybox. I described what happened, and then they turned off the camera. An NBC reporter was there doing a stand-up, and he'd listened to what I described. And he said, "I don't get it. Why wasn't I arrested?" I said, "Oh, are you out covering the protests?" And he said, "No." So I said, like Woody Allen says, 90% of life is just showing up. I mean, I'm not getting arrested in the skybox either. But, you know, it's our job to be in all of these places, on the convention floor getting the orchestrated word, trying to get into those corporate suites where the Republican Governors Association is being feted by whatever the Oil and Gas Association or the Democratic campaign, senatorial campaign committee, what corporation is partying with them, buying the suites for them in every sense. And that's our job. That's the basic tenet of journalism, follow the money. But it's also our job to be out in the streets, to bring out the voices of the uninvited guests. Democracy is a messy thing, and it's our job to capture it all, at all. And it shouldn't, we shouldn't have to get a record to put things on the record. That's a critical point everywhere, especially when you look at places like Iraq. Where it's Arab media workers who've been hit the hardest. The numbers of journalists who have been killed, like Mazen Dana, a great Palestinian journalist who was covering Iraq for Reuters, one of their leading cameramen, who was shot by the U.S. military outside of Abu Ghraib. They said they engaged a cameraman. Or Tariq Ayub, it was April 8th, 2003, the day before the statue of Saddam Hussein was pulled down by the U.S. Marines in Firdaus Square. He had just gone over the border from Jordan to cover the war for Al Jazeera. And he went up on the roof just to set his camera and was about to climb down when he was strafed by U.S. military and he was killed. His wife, Dima Taboog, at his funeral shouted, "Hate breeds hate. The U.S. says they're fighting terrorism. Who's involved with terrorism now?" The next day, or that same day, just after Tariq was killed, and right after the U.S. military had shelled Abu Dhabi TV with their broadcasters yelling on the air, "Help us, help us," they set their sights on the Palestine Hotel, where so many hundreds of unembedded journalists were. And they strafed the hotel, and they killed two journalists, Taras Pratsyuk, a Ukrainian cameraman who was reporting for Reuters, and Jose Coso, the Spanish cameraman who was filming on the balcony for Telecinco television in Spain. He filmed his own death. His brother, his mother, his family continues to this day to try to get justice, to open investigation why the U.S. military, knowing that the Palestine Hotel housed hundreds of unembedded journalists, why they attacked the hotel. You know, I think the embedding process has brought the media to an all-time low. Reporters being embedded in the front lines of troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, I'm not saying the reporters aren't brave, but what do you get when you sleep with the troops, eat with the troops, when your life is in their hands? You get an image of a conflict from the trigger end. You're looking at it through the scopes. What does it feel like to be at the target end? What does it feel like to be in an Iraqi community, an Afghan hospital, to be embedded in the peace movement around the world, to understand the full effects of war? And not only being embedded in troops, the problem is being embedded in the establishment in Washington. All too often, reporters at the White House news conferences enjoy the access of evil. That's trading truth for access. and that all has to be challenged, that all has to be stopped. I just end back where I began when I was talking about my mother and the Holocaust, with this remarkable brother and sister who weren't Jewish. They were German Christians in the Holocaust, and their names were Hans and Sophie Scholl. They thought, what can we do in the face of the Nazi atrocity? And they formed the White Rose Collective with their professors and other workers, and they decided to try to get out information so that the Germans would never be able to say, we didn't know. And they published a series of pamphlets, six in all, and on the fourth pamphlet was written across the top, we will not be silent. Hans and Sophie Scholl, their professor, were arrested, they were tried, they were convicted, and they were beheaded. But that philosophy, that motto, should be the Hippocratic Oath of the media today. We will not be silent. Democracy Now!
This is CFRO 102.7 Co-op Radio in Vancouver, your alternative voice. That was Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! In Vancouver, November 25, 2009. She spoke at the Vancouver Public Library after being held up by Canadian border guards protecting Canada from free speech. Amy has a new book out called Breaking the Sound Barrier, edited by Dennis Moynihan. To fit within our hour, we had to edit out 20 minutes. You can download the full speech in the EcoShock feature section at ecoshock.org. Recording by Alex Smith. Thanks for listening to the Tuesday Brown Bagger, where we present the best of Vancouver speeches every Tuesday at noon on CFRO, your listener-supported radio station. Tune in Monday to Thursdays at 6 a.m. for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman at 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio.